This presentation is brought to you by iawaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Starting off then with chapter 11, some of the issues that are of concern. Does anybody want to raise any of the issues? In reading through this chapter, what do you see as some of the issues that we need to deal with?
The first thing is very bewildering. He wants to put the right eyes out.
Yeah, weird thing. He wants to ask, what do you want from us? He said, put your right eyes out. It's a strange one. Any other points? And Shaul's image of cutting the oxen, that's something we need to look at. What else? Okay, we'll see if there's any connection. Doesn't appear to be, but we'll see that. Anything else?
Yep. What's the point when 7 days there was going to be a fight or an attack or whatever? Why wait 7 days? Why go ahead and do it?
Who should have gone ahead and do it? Nachash or the Israelites should have done it?
The Ammonite camp.
The Ammonite camp. Why did they even wait for it?
Why did they wait 7 days? It doesn't mention any ransom.
What was the benefit for them to wait that period of time? Okay, we'll deal with those and some of the other issues. Starting off at the beginning, one of the big debates at the moment is the extent to which genetics can be blamed for nearly anything. And there seems to be more and more of a move to blame more and more on genetics. That there's that's just the way you are and that's it. I saw recently the other day in one of the papers that even religion they're now trying to say is genetic issues. It's all in the genes. Even in that there's no real choice. That of course is one's own. One understands that, yes, that one achieves oneself. Then it's genetic once again. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. So we seem to have clarified very clearly then what the decision is. Any impediments in one's personality are genetically induced. Any achievements and outstanding features of one's personality is due to one's own, not even one's parents, correct, upbringing. It is one's own effort despite one's parents and one's upbringing. But what we will be looking at in this chapter is the relationship between genetics and self-development, between the nurture and the nature, in the way they put it. Do you see that anywhere in this? Do you see that as being the underlying theme of this chapter? If I were to say this chapter deals with the relationship between the genetic and the environmental components, would you see that? No. So if I can show that to you, then you'll be surprised. Okay, let's try and surprise you. The way we used to do it previously, there was no real fun because you used to think it was all in the text. Now I want to show you this evening. You've read it. I've now told you what it's about and you're saying, oh no, it's not about that. Can't be about that. Doesn't say anything about that. But let's explore it and let's understand what this is all is. What this conflict between Ammon and Shaul is. Why Shaul's first test of leadership is in a battle against the people of Ammon. Who are they? Why are they? Why are they so significant? Why this crazy idea of piercing out the right eye? What does it mean? Where does it come from? And I'm telling you that underlying this is the debate of the relative importance of what one's born with and what one achieves through one's own actions and one's own environment. Then let's have a look at that first sentence. Sentence starts, all of a sudden, we ended last time, there was a big party, Shaul was crowned as the first king of Israel. Next chapter. Nachash HaAmoni comes, Nachash of Ammon. Vayichan al Yavesh Gilad, and he camps out at Yavesh Gilad. Vayomru kol anshei Yavesh al Nachash, the people of Yavesh are terrified of Nachash, the Ammonite. And they say, Keros lonu bris v'na'avdecho. We're not even going to get into battle with you. Just tell us what you want, and we will serve you. We'll pay taxes to you, we will serve you. Just tell us what you want from us. They surrender, we fall, there's a shot fired. Vayomer aleihem Nachash ha'Amoni bezoisech lo yislochem. And Nachash says, this is what I shall demand of you. Bin kor lochem kol ein yomin. I want each one of you to pierce out their right eye. V'samtio cherpo al kol Yisrael. And that will be a disgrace to all of Israel. That's what I want. Who is this Nachash ha'Amoni? Where does he come from? Who are Ammon? What is the battle about? Well, the Medrash says a strange thing. There's a bit of discussion in the Medrash as to whether this is to be taken literally or not. There are parts of the Tanakh that have to be taken literally. There are parts that are clearly not literal. And there's debate on this one. Did he really mean you've all got to pierce out your right eye? Now, for example, when the Torah says eye for an eye, you know the famous phrase, there's no question that that is not literal. There's no view in the Gemara anywhere that suggests that that might be literal. On this issue, when Nachash the Ammonite says, I want you to pierce out the right eye of each one of the people of Yavesh Gilad, there is debate as to whether that means a literal piercing out or it means something else. And there are a couple of different views as to what else it might mean. The one view is the following. Rabbonon Amri, the rabbi, said, Zeh Sefer Torah, he was not after their right eye. He was after their right eye, meaning the Torah. The way you see the world. I want you to pierce out that organ by which you perceive the world, the way you see the world, your right eye. What is there in our Torah that he's so upset about, that he's so angry about? What is there in the way we perceive the world that bothers Ammon? Amalei Nachash HaAmoni, what Nachash said was, Haviu li Sefer Torah, bring me a Sefer Torah, ve'ekor mitoichoi lo yavoi Ammoni, and I shall excise from the Sefer Torah the phrase, no Ammonite shall ever marry into the Jewish people. I object to that phrase in the Torah. It's not democratic, it's intolerant, it goes against all our principles, it might even be unconstitutional. Can we close that door there? Yes. Close it, lock it, do whatever you want. It's that sentence in the Torah that I want to excise. If you'll do that for me, then you can serve me. I won't come into war against you. So this is a religious battle. This is an ideological battle. He's not out to conquer the area of Yavesh Gilad. He's out to conquer one phrase in the Torah. What is that phrase? And no Ammonite shall ever marry into the Jewish people. Where do we have that phrase and why is that so? In Dvorim, in the book of Deuteronomy, we're told the following. Exactly that. He's quite right. There is such an intolerant sentence. Lo yovoi Ammoni o Moavi b'kehal Hashem. No Ammonite, no Moabite shall ever marry into the Jewish nation. Now, Egyptians are allowed to marry. Egyptian converts, 3 generations later, he can marry a Jew. Egyptian, look what they did to us. We just celebrated Pesach. They're prepared to forgive that. You know? At the end of the day, they want to marry and we'll take them in. A German? Can marry in. A Nazi can marry in. Wants to do tshuva, wants to convert, become Jewish, marry a nice young Jewish girl, no objection. An Ammonite, not you. Was there ever an Ammonite Holocaust? No. Did the Ammonites ever enslave us? No. What did they do? Why would we take such a line against the Ammonites? What did they do? Torah tells us exactly what they did. It's not what they did, it's what they didn't do. Al davar asher lo yikidnu eschem balechem uvamayim bederech betzeischem in Mitzrayim. Do you remember when you were coming out of Egypt? You needed to buy food and water. And they didn't offer to sell. They didn't offer to supply you with your needs while you were coming out of Egypt. And for that, we will never forgive them. They can never marry into the Jewish people. The Germans, yes, 6 million Jews they wiped out, but we'll take them in. The Egyptians tortured us for decades and decades, centuries. We'll take them in. The Spanish expelled us from Spain, killed us. We'll take them in. Christians who were on the Crusades and killed people for being Jews, take them in. The Ammonites didn't kill one Jew. There's no record of an Ammonite killing a Jew. That's not the issue. They wouldn't supply bread and water when we needed. For that we won't take them. What was so terrible about that? The Ramban says it's not that in isolation. We have a history with the Ammonites. But before I disclose the history that we have with the Ammonites, let us examine that in light of the spectrum of cruelty. What can one do? What is the range of cruelty that a person can engage in? On the one extreme of cruelty is, if helping you costs me, I won't help you. That's one level of cruelty. So you come to me for charity and I say, sorry, you know, I've got my own needs, my own causes, I can't help you. And you say to me, and if you could help me in a way that doesn't cost you anything, would you help me? I say, sure. Didn't cost me, I would, but I can't pay for you. So the one form of cruelty, the least severe form of cruelty is when I say I cannot help you if it's going to cost me. The next one is, even if it doesn't cost me, I wouldn't help you. That second one is called Midas Sodom. That was the kind of civilization that existed in Sodom. Midas Sodom. Zenehne vezeloi chosen. Somebody could benefit without costing you anything and you don't allow it, that's called a characteristic of Sodom. So the examples the Gemara gives for example is I have a store on the road, the street, with an overhang, and it's raining, El Nino is still around, and you're standing under my overhang and I say, please move off. I don't want you standing here. It doesn't cost me anything, I don't suffer anything, but I forbid you from standing. That's a midas sodom. It's not costing you anything. Why would you chase the person away? So the Torah takes a very dim view of a person who refuses a kindness that doesn't cost. It's bad enough when a person refuses a kindness that does cost. But when a person refuses a kindness that doesn't cost, the Torah takes a very dim view. Now, if we take the obverse of those two, and we take the cruelty a step further, and we say, if I refuse to do a kindness to you when the kindness costs me, then I am, by refusing to do the kindness, I am causing you suffering, isn't that so, to some degree? You want me to help you, or I could help you, I do not do so. So I'm causing you suffering, but I'm benefiting from the suffering I'm causing you. And this is just a harsher way of saying the same thing. We don't feel all that uncomfortable if we say, when it costs me, I won't help. That's still civilized. It might be nasty, but it's civilized. But if I say the same thing in different words, and I say, if I can benefit from causing you discomfort, I will. Do you follow that that's the same thing? Just more uncivilized, but it's exactly the same. That we would say is intolerant. If I said to you, do you know this person? If he can benefit from torturing you, he'll torture you. No, I can't believe there's anybody like that. And if I said to you, there's somebody else I know, not that, but he won't help you if it costs him anything. Actually the same thing. It's benefit to me, benefit to somebody else. I will be willing to see the discomfort of somebody else rather than expend any discomfort of my own. So if we take then that one, and the next one is, I will cause you discomfort even if it doesn't cost me anything. I don't want you standing under my overhang in the rain. It doesn't cost me anything. I don't want you to get that benefit. That's Midas Sodom. If we put that in a less civilized way, I will cause you pain even if I get no benefit. that you get the full spectrum. The full spectrum is, I will not help you if it costs me. Next one. I will not help you even if it doesn't cost me. Next one. I will cause you pain, even so long as I will cause you pain if I can benefit from that. The fourth one, I will cause you pain even if I don't benefit from it, just for the fun of causing you pain. That's the ultimate of cruelty. So the first and the third are obverse sides of the same coin, and the second and the fourth are obverse sides of the same coin. So if Midat Sodom is, don't stand under my overhang in the rain, then Midat Sodom is also torture for no benefit. So what do we see in Nachash's response? Which of the four forms do we see? The Sodom form. With that piercing out somebody's eye, what benefit do you get from that? They come along and say, tell us what you want from us, we'll give it to you and we'll serve you. Nachash's answer, I want your right eye. Any benefit to Nachash? No. Why does he do it? That's it, it's cruelty. He gets pleasure from causing somebody else pain. Now, if that's the Sodom level, let's question where this comes from. Are you with me that you understand that that is the Sodom? I need to run through it again. The Gemara analyzes two forms of spitefulness, let's call it that. A spitefulness from which you gain, and a spitefulness from which you gain nothing. Sodom is the second one. Spitefulness from which you gain nothing. That's called Midah Sodom. If you're spiteful but you benefit, that's bad character, but it's not Sodom. Sodom are the people who lived in that terrible place that God wiped out, where Lot went, Abraham's nephew. And what they did was, they were spiteful just for the sake of being spiteful. You know all the stories about Sodom. If you used to come to them, the guests used to come, they used to say, gee, you're too tall for our beds over here. We'd better decapitate you, or at least not with your feet, or 6 inches of your legs so that you fit. We don't like people who don't fit in here. Very, very similar to today. We have a template, we have a mold, and if you don't fit in, we knock off a bit here, and we knock off a bit here, until we get you into the template. And then you're one of us. That was Sodom. Do they get any benefit from that? No. You don't get any benefit from that at all. It was torture. People were too short, they used to stretch. They used to enjoy torture. They were sadistic. They used to enjoy torture. So the one kind of meanness, the one kind of spitefulness is spiteful where there's gain, that's bad character. Spiteful where there's no gain. The spiteful where there's gain, if we take it into the cruelty level, means being cruel because I get something out of it. So slave labor. That would forfeit into that character. Oppressing another person so as to increase my profits. That would fall into that category. Overworking a person. Depriving a person of something which is his right. All of that would be examples of bad character. Cases of where I am oppressing another person for my benefit. That's not Sodom. That's selfish. That's self-centered. That's mean. That's bad character, but it's not Sodom. The next step is Sodom. Oppressing you for no benefit. So I tell my worker, you finished your work and it's 6 o'clock in the evening, you stay here till 9. Why should I stay here till 9? Why can't I go back to my family? You want a job tomorrow, you stay here till 9. Do you gain anything by my staying here till 9? No, I don't, but I like to know that you're here. That's me, that's Sodom. You're gaining nothing and the other person is suffering. That's Midah Sodom. So piercing out the eye, torture without gain, is Midah Sodom. Are you with it? Okay. Now, what is the linkage between Midah Sodom? Let's look back to a verse in Bereshis. You remember the story, God was going to destroy Sodom. And he was going to destroy Sodom because he didn't like the way they behaved. He didn't like exactly this element of their character. So there have been only twice that God wanted to destroy a whole city, a whole community. One was the flood, and why did he want to destroy the world in the time of the flood? What were they doing wrong? Theft. Dishonesty in business. Second time, Sodom. Why did he want to destroy Sodom? Bad character, mean, nasty. But you don't find God wanting to destroy places because they don't keep kosher.
That doesn't mean that it's not right to keep kosher. It is. And God likes it when we keep kosher, and He doesn't like it when we don't keep kosher. You don't find God wanting to destroy places because they don't keep Shabbos. God likes us to keep Shabbos. He's told us that. You don't find God wanting to destroy places because they don't fast on Yom Kippur. God destroys communities when they treat each other badly. That's when He destroys communities. That's when He gets angry. The flood was theft, and Sodom was meanness. He destroys it with fire. And Abraham argues, the famous argument with God, he says, but God, why destroy the whole city? There might be 100 good people there. If you leave the city alone for the 100 good people, God, if there were 100, I would leave it. And he goes down, he comes to 50, and 40, and 30, and 20. He says, maybe there are 10 good people in Sodom. God says, if there were 10, I would also leave it. There aren't even 10. Of course, Abraham knows there's one family. His nephew, Lot, the rabbi of Sodom, chief rabbi of Sodom. That he's the only one. Small congregation he's got. No, he probably had a very big congregation. Don't think that because they were mean to each other, they weren't frum. Don't think that. They were frum. He had a big frum congregation. They were religious. They probably didn't drive on Shabbos. They kept kosher. Their children went to yeshivas. Who knows what went on there? We don't know about that part of it. All we know is they were mean. They might have been very frum, but they were mean. Frum people can be mean. It happens. Very rarely, but it can happen. God says He's going to destroy it, but He'll save Lot. He goes, gets Lot out, the angels come there and get Lot, Mrs. Lot, and their two daughters out. Mrs. Lot looks back, you'll remember, turns into a pillar of salt. At least three people. Mr. Lot, Rabbi Lot, and two daughters Lot. They think the world has been destroyed. Don't forget there's no CNN at that time, so they don't know what's going on in the rest of the world. All they see is that everywhere around them, they go up onto the hills, they see smoke, fire, devastation. And they assume the world has once again been destroyed, and they, like Noah, have been saved as the only family. But when Noah was saved, it was Mr. and Mrs. Noah, and Mr. Shem and Mrs. Shem, and Mr. Ham and Mrs. Ham, and Mr. Yefes and Mrs. Yefes. So there was a chance to re-establish civilization. They looked around, there's one father, two daughters, that's it. So this is like going back to the time of Adam. And they worked out very simply, therefore there's going to have to be incestuous relationship once again. They give their father something to drink, and they seduce their father. The two girls. And they have children. Bateled habechiro bein, and the first one has a child, batikro shmoi Moab. And she called his name Moab. Batziro gamhi yeldo bein, and the younger one also had a child, out of that relationship with her father. Batikro Shemoi Ben Ami, and she called that child Ben Ami, the son of my people. Hu Avi Bnei Amon Ad Hayon. He was the founder of the Amon nation till today. So what do we see? Cruelty in Nachash Ben Amon, the Nachash of Amon, centuries later, is the same cruelty that used to be in Sodom. But where did the people of Ammon pick up this kind of cruelty? And let's look at it. We've got this kind of cruelty twice. The one case is, when you were coming out of Egypt, what did you want to do to buy the water? You didn't want to steal it. You didn't want it for nothing. You wanted to trade with it. If a nation refuses to trade, what is that? That's Sodom. That's Sodom. So I'm not even willing to sell to you. That's Sodom. I'm willing to give to you. That's not Sodom. I'm not willing to give you a grant. I'm not willing to give you charity. That's not Sodom. But I'm not willing to trade with you at any price. That's Sodom. What have you got to lose? Fix your price and I'll pay. At no price will I sell to you. That's Sodom. That's meanness. That's cruelty. Amon. What can we do for you? We'll become your slaves. Pierce out your right eye. Yes. This is Sodom characteristic. But Ammon is not descended from the people of Sodom. Who's Ammon's mother? The daughter of Lot. Who's Lot? Abraham's nephew. They come from the same stock that we do. Where do we get the chesed, the kindness, the sympathy and empathy that typifies the Jewish person? And Ammon gets the absolute opposite extreme. It can only be environment. That's where Amun gets it. Amun was raised, Amun's family, this is the family that lived in Sidon. It's true he was the rabbi, their father was the rabbi of Sidon. It's true that they tried to keep their family separate. But it's very difficult when there is a prevailing value system and there isn't even a community of people that oppose that value system. And Avraham said, maybe 10 people there aren't part of the value system. God said, there aren't 10, I've checked with him. There weren't even 10 people, there wasn't one other family that opposed the value system, the prevailing value system of Sidon. That encroaches on the whole family. And the family starts to absorb it. Now I understand why the family at that time might have been affected by the Sidon characteristics. Why does this carry on now genetically? If we're saying it's environmental, why does it all of a sudden become genetic? Either it's environmental, in which case by now it should be finished. They've been out of stone. In fact, this baby was never in stone. He was born out of stone. The family was in stone. And they've been out of stone for centuries. If it's environmental, where's the environmental effect? Why are we still holding that against them? And if they would marry into us and become part of our community, surely just as Sodom changed them, so our community would change them too. So is this environmental or is it genetic? If it's genetic, their genes are not different to ours. If it's environmental, why can't they marry in and they'll lose the environmental impact of Sodom and they'll gain the environmental impact of us? What do we see? Something can start as an environmental impact and can transmutate into a genetic. The genes are not just things you're born with. Genes are things that can evolve during a lifetime. And a lifetime doesn't necessarily mean one person's lifetime, it might mean over a period of time, over several generations. That the genetics is not, because at the end of the day, we all come from Adam. So if genetics was purely inherited, we would all have the same genes, we would all be clones. The fact is, we're not. Although we all come from Adam and Eve, we all have the same parents, we do not have the same genes. What does that tell us? The genes change. The genes themselves are not purely inherited. The genes can develop. One can develop something which becomes part of you and almost impossible to eradicate, which started off environmentally and then becomes really part of you. That even if you change the environment, you don't lose it. It's there for good, at least for the foreseeable period. At what point does Amun lose his right to marry into the Jewish nation? When he was born? No. Is it because he was the child of an incestuous marriage? No. At that point he could still marry in. Is it because he came from Sodom? No. In the time in between Egypt, Sodom and Egypt, an Ammonite could marry a Jew. That wasn't the problem. When did he give up his right to marry the Jewish people? When he refused to sell them food. When he reinforced his genetic, when he reinforced his environmental origins in conduct that was totally unacceptable. That reinforcement of one's environment through one's own conduct becomes genetic. If you live in a bad environment, and that sort of affects you a little bit, that doesn't become genetic. When you start acting like the people in your environment, that becomes you. And you can then emigrate, you can go to Meir Shorim office, and you'll have children who will have the same genes. The Los Angeles genes will come with it, or the San Francisco genes will come with it, or the Johannesburg genes will come with it. If you start acting like the people of your society over a consistent period of time, that becomes you. And when you emigrate, you don't leave that behind. When you emigrate, you take that with you. And that becomes part of the new you. And it takes centuries before eventually that starts working itself out of the system, if it ever does. So when the Ammonites started acting like Sodom, centuries after they left Sodom, God said, I see that Sodom is in your blood. And that will never tolerate inside the Jewish people. That has to be canceled. We can have all sorts of people, they can be trained, they can be changed, but not this. Ammon is excluded. And so when Nachash, the Ammonite, comes along, what is he fighting for? Again, typical Ammon, what does he want? He wants the sentence in the Torah removed. Is that going to change him? Is that going to make him a better person? No, he wants to change the eye. He wants to change the way you see me. I won't change. I just want to change the way I am perceived. I'm dealing with illusions. I'm not becoming more moral, but I want you to perceive me as being more moral. I don't want you to exclude me from your nation. I don't want a sentence in the Torah that says I may not marry into your nation. That I don't want to be. So when he says I want to remove your eye, what are we saying? What is the image? I want to remove the way you see me without my changing myself at all. That's what I want. And here we see the consistent Amon behavior all the way through. No change in the individual, no sacrifice in the individual, no willing to pay a price on the part of the individual, just wanting to change the image. Shortcut, shortest route to any kind of change, but not changing the person itself. That's the clash between Amon and Israel that Shaul inherits as the first test of his kingdom, of his ability to be king. How is he going to deal with it? How is he going to handle this? Questions. The first question is, it was only the time of Ruth that the idea was innovated that this prohibition applied only to the men and not to the women. The reason being because there was no genetic defect found in the women. There are many genetic diseases which is only in one sex, and this was one of them. There was no sign of a genetic defect in the women of Moab. The Moab works out how that is so and why that is so. That's all the more credence to the fact that it was genetic. If it was environmental, it should have been men and women equally. The fact that it's genetic makes sense, but it's only the men and not the women. The other question that you asked about the Egyptians, yes, they have genetic defects, but not this defect. All other defects one can live with. None of us are perfect. God's not saying the Jews are perfect and everybody else is bad. He's saying we're all bad in different ways. But there's one kind of badness that cannot come into the Jewish people, because that will destroy us. And that is cruelty with no benefit. Expedient cruelty is bad enough, but cruelty with no benefit, that's not Jewish. And Jews have never been like that. And sometimes you get an individual, but as a nation, even in warfare, we've never been like that. We've never been tortured, we've never taken any kind of pleasure in any kind of cruelty that yields no benefit. What was the benefit? And therefore you're saying they might be descendants of Amon. They might be. Some of them might be descendants of Amon. The whole thing started off with some kind of benefit because Hitler was able to gain popularity and blame the recession on the Jews. And his whole rise to power was built on Jewish hatred. So the initial introduction of anti-Semitism of that intensity had great benefit for them. They were able to mobilize an entire nation against a common enemy. The way each individual treated the Jews, of course, that became extreme. And yes, maybe the Ammonite descendants today, we don't know who Ammon is or who Ammon is. Maybe they are the German people. We don't know who they are. Okay, let us get a little further into the issue. Thank you for the question. The next thing to look at is Shaul, interestingly enough, if you look in verse 4, when they come to cry to Shaul, verse 5, Pinei Shaul ba acharei habokar min hasodeh. And Shaul was walking in to his administrative buildings behind the cattle. The question is, what was he doing walking behind the cattle? We have two views there. Rashi and most people take the view, he just happened to be walking behind the cattle. Why is that relevant? We'll see in a moment why that's relevant, because we'll understand what he was thinking as he walked behind the cattle. But the Abarbanel and certain others take the view, he was walking behind the cattle because he didn't start practicing as king yet. You remember at the end of the previous chapter, there were people who hadn't accepted him. There were people who didn't accept him yet as king. And until the entire nation accepted him as king, he carried on being a shepherd. That was the modesty of Shaul. He knew he was king, he was anointed king, he was appointed king. He carried on the same as before, until everybody accepted him. Importantly though, as he was walking behind the cattle, what was going through his mind was a study of the synergy of a span of oxen, how they work as a team, and what would happen if they were pulling in different directions. As this is going through his mind, they come and tell him the story of Amram. And he realizes the most important function of central government, and that is to impose the responsibility of one part of the nation on the other part of the nation. And take the United States, it's a good example of that. If each state were a separate country, then we would not be affected in California by a recession that might be taking place in one of the other states. To some degree, I suppose we're not, and vice versa, but to some degree we are. The understanding, and certainly when it comes to matters of warfare, the fact that one state is threatened by a foreign enemy, it's not just Californians that would protect Californians from a threat by a foreign enemy. The principle of nationhood is the whole nation gets involved. And anybody who wants to pick a fight with California better realize that it's a fight with the United States. That's what a country is. That's what a nation is. And this is all going through Shaul's mind as he's walking behind the cattle. And as he gets to his destination, he's told of the threat of Nachash against one town, Yavesh Gilead. And he says, this is my chance to unite the people. The response has to be a national response. The response is not going to be a local response. We're not going to work out what are the people of Yavesh Gilead going to do with Ammon, nor are we going to allow the people of Yavesh Gilead to get into an independent treaty with the people of Ammon. If Ammon wants to pick a battle with Yavesh Gilead, Ammon is picking a battle with me, says Shaul. And if Ammon is picking a battle with me, he's picking a battle with the nation of Israel. And if I can mobilize the entire nation behind the people of Yavesh Gilead, then I am king. If I cannot do that, I am not king. I'm king only in name. And so he starts to motivate them with a very interesting phrase. He takes the cattle, he has them killed and divided, and he sends them around very graphically. Sends them around and shows the people what separation of an animal is, how dysfunctional it is when it separates. And he says, "Asher einenu yotzei achar Shaul v'achar Shmuel," in verse 7. Any part of the nation that does not come out behind Shaul and behind Shmuel, don't try and drive any kind of wedge between the king and the prophet. This is the first time that there's a decision that has to be taken by the king. Up until now, the country was ruled by only one man, the prophet. We now have two people at the head of the nation. We have a prophet and a king. So Shaul, don't think that you can drive any kind of wedge between Shaul and Shmuel. We're going out to this together. And if anybody tries to destroy, if anybody does not join the battle against Ammon, Ko ye'atzeliv koroi, we will destroy his cattle. A very powerful statement, very dictatorial, very assertive, very uncompromising. That's the message. Here's a destroyed animal. This is what will happen to your herds if you don't come out after us. We'll send in the police and we'll destroy your animals. We'll destroy your wealth. Now, you don't have a choice to sit on the fence. You're going to either fight this battle or you'll have nothing. Now, the next phrase is what's quite intriguing. Vayipol pachad Hashem alav. And the people were instilled with the fear of God. Why the fear of God? Why not the fear of Shaul? Where did God come into? Shaul has threatened them with destitution if they don't follow. Shaul has threatened them with the destruction of all of their wealth. So why doesn't it say they were instilled with the fear of Shaul, the fear of the government? By Yetzu ki ish echod, they went out like one man, united in spirit, united in intent, united in purpose. How did he do that?
What you see here and there is the greatness of Shaul. It wasn't just a threat, it will destroy your wealth. What Shaul was saying is, this is so important, this is so critical, you don't have a right to wealth if you don't form part of the nation in this battle. And this is God's will, this is how it needs to be. I'm imposing you this on you not because it's my own idea. This comes from Shmuel, and this comes from he and I consulting. But our decision is that this is the will of God. And the people bought into it morally, not just as something they had to do to save their cattle. It was the fear of God, there was a moral fear that they had in themselves. By Yetzu Kish Echod, and there was absolute unity of purpose. It wasn't each one going out to protect his own cattle. Each one was going out to protect the will of God. Each one was going out to protect the nation of God.
there was complete unanimity. Sholem managed to galvanize the entire nation into one moral principle, and that is, we'll fight Ammon together. And the story comes, and they are victorious, they destroy Ammon. And then the people come and say, by Yomer Ha'omel Shmuel, the battle is over, celebrating. They said to Shmuel, Mi Ha'omer Shmuel Yiboy Chalek. Do you remember? A couple of days ago, at the party we had, the coronation of Shaul, there were people there, Anshei Beliyahu, you remember, decadent people, who were saying, how is this man going to save us? Look what he did to us. Look how he mobilized the whole nation. Look how he destroyed Ammon, how he wiped them out. Where are those people? Let us kill those people. Here we're going to be in, here we are introduced to a law which is going to raise its head several times for the Shua. And that is the law of Moreh the Malchus. One of the laws that Shmuel taught them before he gave them a king. He said to them, I'll give you a king, but you need to understand that there's not going to be more democracy with a king, there will be less democracy. Because if anybody rebels against the king has to be killed with this. One of the laws of being a king. Cannot tolerate undermining. That destroys the vote. In the debate with him, you want to engage him in discussion, that's fine. And once he issues his decision, anybody who disobeys that decision or undermines his authority is guilty of a capital sin. The principle of Moreh the Malchus. You cannot have a king if he doesn't have the right to kill. There has to be that level of fear for him to punish him as a king. And therefore they say, now that he's proved himself, let us kill those people who are undermining him. By Yom HaShoel, and Shoel says, Lo Yomas, Ish by Yom HaZeh, no man should die this day. Ki Hayom Asa Hashem Teshuah B'Yisrael, because this day God has made a victory for Israel. By Yom HaShoel, and Am B'Chu B'Nelcho, and Yudon, come let us go to Gilgal, and Chadeshon, and Lucho, and let us renew the king, let us celebrate the appointment of Shoel once again. Now that everybody is brought in to his royalty, let us celebrate it once again. Vayelchu chol ha'om ha'gilgal vayamlichu sham ha'shaul b'nei Hashem ba'gilgal. They all went to Gilgal, and there they enthroned Shaul once again before God in Gilgal. Vayisbuchu sham zvochim shlomim b'nei Hashem. They brought sacrifices. Vayismach sham Shaul v'chol ha'shem Yisrael ad moed. And there was a great rejoicing there between Shaul and all the people of Israel. Nobody was opposed to him. Nobody questioned his authority. Nobody questioned that he was the right person to appoint. There was complete acceptance of Shaul as being the first king of Israel in the way that he handled this particular conflict between the people of Yabesh Gilad and Israel on the one hand, and Nachash HaAmoni on the other hand. His descendant of Ammon was so firm on removing the bad perception of the Ammonite people, not by changing the conduct of the Ammonite people, not by changing the value system of the Ammonite people, but merely by changing the perception of the Jews of the Ammonites. And that was unacceptable to Shaul, that was unacceptable to Shmuel, that was unacceptable to God and to Jewish people. What brings us to the end of chapter 11, we can have a few minutes of questions. Other people who survived. don't know if he would have made that level of profit. Because there is a free market that operates at the end of the day. So it would have asked outrageous prices. The fact is we managed without their water. They could have gained. You're right, they could have gained and they went far in. You're right, because the bidder of Amun, you're right. It's more than a traditional bidder of Amun. Here there was an opportunity, even for commercial gain. They'd rather see the Jews suffer than the commercial gain. Which also might answer the question about the Nazis. Most Nazis were willing to sell Jews. For the right amount of money, they would let Jews go. But when it came, you offered the money, they were willing to trade. It was just a question of how much money and whether the money could be raised, if not quickly enough. But in most cases, they were willing to trade. Yes, the Rambam's makes it very clear. Genetics doesn't mean that you can't do anything about it. It is possible, and if you take one of the big issues today, of course, is the issue of homosexuality. It's not the only issue today. It's an area of criminality doing that well. But even if you take the area of homosexuality, it is quite possible, and very likely, certain people have homosexual genetic tendencies. But all that a genetic quality means is that it's harder for you to resist. It's very possible, but harder. The Rambam says every one of us has a genetic defect in some area of our lives. It makes it tough for us to write in a particular area. So for one person it's the other homosexual tendency, for another person it's that he gets angry very easily, he's resentful, can't control himself, for another person it's some other area. We all have areas that genetically make it hard for us to do the right thing in that area. That doesn't mean we cannot. It means it's tough, and when we get it right, God rewards us enormously. Because he takes into account the struggle. Part of the reason God gives us that is to be able to upgrade the reward. So there's some areas that you find easy and I find very difficult. And vice versa. You will be rewarded for the things you find hard more than I will, because those things I find easy. So the genetic quality does not restrict the person, and where it does restrict and make it possible, then of course he is responsible. And that's the case when the Gemara talks about a cherish, right? The concept of a person is insane, a person is deaf and dumb, and cannot communicate. Those are impediments that make it impossible for him to function and therefore to be held accountable. But the other genetic tendencies are tendencies of varying degrees of strength for which we remain responsible. Like somebody saying, imagine a situation, God forbid, but somebody who has AIDS wants to marry a daughter-in-law, and I know it's not a good thing, and I'm willing to go to medication and to take all the precautions that one would normally take. It's tragic. The genetic deficiencies cause enormous tragedy, as we were discussing with the Morrish here earlier. Enormous human tragedy. And it takes a long time to wash that out if it ever does get washed out. The only thing that Ammonite could do is marry an Ammonite and their daughters could become Jewish. And he himself, he can live among the Jewish people, he can be kind, he can be part of the social community, but not part of the genetic pool. Too dangerous. Just too dangerous. You can't risk bringing Sodom. God destroyed Sodom. The only one who got out was Lot and his daughters. There's a little bit of Sodom that they acquired too. That can't be incorporated into the Jewish people just today. See, but she was married before. She was the Sodomite's daughter. No, Lot was married before she was. That she was a fine woman, and Abraham at that time would have had a certain influence on Lot as to who he married, and she must have been a very fine woman. And Lot a fine man. Okay, let's leave it there, and we'll have any other decisions. You want to do another Kaddish? Sure. Just before you do that, Denise, are there any announcements?